Welcome to the Novel Romantics Literature of Chicago podcast series at the Amerikazentrum Hamburg. I'm the host of Novel Romantics, Douglas Cowie. I'm a writer and teacher. In each episode of this series, my guests and I will discuss a work of literature set primarily in Chicago. And for this episode, we'll be discussing The Coast of Chicago by Stuart Dybeck, which was first published in 1990. My guest today is Gregory Miller. Gregory Miller is an educator and avid reader. He was a classroom teacher for 12 years and now works in a nonprofit community organization doing outreach. His passion in work has been to create community-based opportunities for young people who haven't found success in traditional education. Welcome, Greg.
Hey, welcome. Thanks for having me back, Doug.
Thanks for welcoming me to my own podcast. Today, we're going to discuss The Coast of Chicago by Stuart Dybeck. As I said, it was first published in 1990. There's a lot of things to talk about here, and it's a really exciting book of short stories. Most, if not all, of those short stories are set in the Pilsen neighborhood of Chicago, which is itself it is a very interesting neighborhood now. It was a very interesting neighborhood in 1990. A lot of the stories here are set kind of in the 50s and 60s, and it was also a very interesting neighborhood then. And you lived in Pilsen. So I wonder, maybe that's a good place to start. It's just tell us a bit about the neighborhood of Pilsen for people who don't know it.
Yeah, Pilsen's it's a fascinating neighborhood. It's on the southwest side of Chicago, not too far from downtown in the scheme of things. The main drag in Pilsen, what is kind of called Pilsen today, is 18th Street. In the book, his area of Pilsen includes what's called Little Village as well, which is 26th Street is kind of the main drag in that area. But they're fairly contiguous neighborhoods. Nowadays, vast majority of residents are of Mexican descent. Pilsen has, at this point, a lot of second, third generation families living there. Little Village has had more, is beginning to become, you know, second and third generation, but a little more recent immigration. So really, that's kind of the entry point for Chicago's very, very large Mexican population is centered around Pilsen and Little Village today, mm-hmm. Which is a process that started in the 60s, which is kind of when the book takes place. And so you see that throughout the book here. There's like his friends kind of represent the flow of that community at that time, which is before it was a Mexican neighborhood. It was I guess Slavic neighborhood. So Pilsen, the name might suggest that it's it has a lot of Czech or Bohemian immigrants mm-hmm. coming into it, a lot of Poles, Germans as well. So it's, you know, like Chicago, it's these ethnic neighborhoods that are continue to be holding onto their traditions, immigrants. So it's changed over time, and it started to change a lot in the 60s from being European immigrants to primarily Mexican immigrants.
Yeah, that change, that sense of shifting neighborhoods and shifting ethnicities, and also the kind of overlapping of those different ethnic and cultural identities it's not the only focus of these stories by a long shot, but it's definitely, in fact, I'm not even sure if it is having just said it's a focus. I'm not sure even it is a focus so much as part of the fabric of these stories. Mm-hmm. And I suppose
it's a subtext it's a subtext of each story. There's kind of some element, and it may or may not play a central role.
The groups of friends that we see traversing these neighborhoods are often themselves a mix of ethnicities, sometimes within one character. There's one character who is half Mexican and half Polish. You know, he's like a literal mm-hmm. representation of this kind of flux. And there's a line in the story Hot Ice, which we might end up discussing in more detail at some point, but this is on page 132 of the book. And there's a line that I think encapsulates the kind of thing you were just talking about. So this line in the story is about the story, but it's really about the neighborhood and kind of reflects the way you were just talking about it. He says, "Nobody was there, just the wall, railroad tracks, the river, and the factories that lined it. Boundaries that remained intact while neighborhoods came and went." So there's like this idea that the physical space of the city or the neighborhoods that don't really change. The river is going to be there. The railroad tracks aren't moving. The buildings are all there. I mean, buildings come and go these days, but at least for the purposes of this story, the buildings are all intact. But the neighborhood and the sense of what the neighborhood means is shifting through this physical space. I think it's a really interesting and kind of useful idea for thinking not just about the fiction here, but about this, like what the fiction says about the city or what a city even is. I don't know what you think about that. Or
there's this. I mean, there's it's fascinating, and I'm you know having lived briefly in that area and really loved that kind of it was a cool time in my own life personally, and so it's I lived there when I met my wife, and so there's a certain halo that it has in my own personal memory. But the physical space there is just fascinating, and he's really attuned to it. And it's interesting to me how much, what he's describing, there's a continuity in the spaces. I mean, one of the places where he lived is his grandmother's house. The first story in here, Chopin and Winter, mm-hmm. is set, at his grandparents' apartment on 18th Street, which is this like huge, kind of iconic building on 18th Street. It's right across from what I think is the best coffee shop in the city of Chicago, the Jumping Bean. But it's still there. It's a sort of, I don't know what you would call it architecturally, maybe Beaux Arts or something like that. But this big, it's kind of bigger than the other buildings, but it's looming there. Mm-hmm. When the story is set, I think in the early 60s, maybe, it's already an old building. Right. And it's full of all these old immigrants and these, what do they call it? What's the Polish word for grandma?
I've forgotten because the grandfather is called Zsa, and I've forgotten entirely.
Zsa and Bub. Oh, Bubcha actually is what my Polish friend, his mother was called Bubcha. Maybe that's what the problem. I think they had a different nickname though. But yeah, there's this continuity of the buildings, but the neighborhood flows, and it's maybe we could talk about this at some point here too. Gentrification is a huge issue in the Pilsen area, as it is in so many neighborhoods in the city, and so there's a continued change in who lives there and who benefits from growth. This short story called Blight really highlights kind of that.
I was going to say that's a good segue. You've made it into your own segue instead of letting me make it into my segue. It doesn't matter. I was going to say I was just like waiting for my moment to say, oh, that's a good segue to talk about Blight. Let's talk about Blight. You've done my hard work for me. This is the opening sentence of that story, which tells the whole story in one sentence, which is something that I really like. It says, during those years between Korea and Vietnam, when rock and roll was being perfected, our neighborhood was proclaimed an official Blight area. And that's the whole story is there in one sentence. And and we can talk about all the ways, let's just talk about the story. It's about these kids. There's not a lot of plot to this story. It's quite a long story with not much plot, which I really like. And it's just about a group of kids kind of in their, I guess, early teenage years, wandering around their neighborhood. The guy narrating the story is looking back on this time from a later in his life, because he's commented a few times on what he was doing then and in relation to mm-hmm. not specific things he's doing now, but you just feel the sense of a lot of time has passed. You described your time in Pilsen as having a halo because of who you were and what you were doing and so on at that time. And there's a certain aspect of that kind of halo of looking back in mm-hmm. the narration here. I think it's one of the things I think is interesting about Dybeck in general is that he often has this a tone of what I want to kind of call semi-nostalgia, because it's not a purely sentimental or overly sentimental nostalgia, like, oh, things were so much better then. But there is a certain fondness. I'm going to borrow your term again, halo. There's like this light around the tone of looking back, even when the things that he's looking back on aren't necessarily nice things. Mm-hmm. But seeing them for being something that's worth preserving nonetheless and has a value in it. And that's kind of what this story is about. It's, the title is Blight. You get it right there. It was the neighborhood was proclaimed an official Blight area. I don't know if you want to talk about what that means for people who might not understand Blight.
Yeah, I mean, it's it's connected to kind of in the 1960s, you know, a lot of cities were, what was the term? It's kind of euphemistic now. Revitalization. Mm-hmm. So they, you know, this idea of revitalizing neighborhoods. It was also the time of building the Eisenhower Interstate Expressway system, which part of revitalization was just the total destruction of neighborhoods. So you had to the north of Pilsen, you had what is the Eisenhower Expressway coming in from, you know, in downtown into the city from the western suburbs. You had as well as the, I guess it's the Dan Ryan, mm-hmm. 94 cutting off the eastern side of the neighborhood. You also had the University of Illinois Chicago being developed and this big campus. So that kind of took the corner where those two expressways intersect, essentially became UIC. And so that kind of precipitated a lot of movement of people, destruction of neighborhoods. And it's almost the catalyst for the changes that go on through that neighborhood. And I think in some ways it's really the catalyst for everything that's happening in this story and a lot of these stories is.
The writer in me wants to dissect almost every word of this sentence. Our neighborhood was proclaimed an official blight area, and it's, you know, it's passive tense. Totally. So the neighborhood isn't declaring itself, like someone is declaring it. It's something that's happening to the neighborhood. And you think like, well, like who, by whom, like, I don't like it when my students write in passive voice. I'm like, by whom? Oh, yeah. You know, you're pushing away responsibility. But the next sentence is a new paragraph, and it says Richard J. Daley was mayor then. And like, there's no question about who. And I think that's an important part of this is that, you know, it was proclaimed an official blight area by someone who could use that designation to enrich his cronies. You know, that if it's a blight area, that depresses property prices. You can buy up land for cheap, or the city can say, well, this is blight and we're taking it over, and they come in with the wrecking balls and developers start making money by building things on them or not building things on them.
Yeah, no, and that's precisely the history of that neighborhood, especially that kind of northeastern area of it, but it kind of continues to expand. But yeah, and then the way that people experience it is, you know, it is a passive voice because they're, for the most part, mm-hmm. didn't have a voice. You know, subsequent to when these stories take place, you find, you know, Pilsen starting in the 80s became a hotbed of community organizing. Mm-hmm. And because up to that point, they had no voice, right? It was just passive. Somebody made decisions and, you know, homes got taken and people were forced to move. So they did organize, you know, in response to that.
So I was going to say, there's a great account of the predecessor to that 1980s community organizing in Mike Royko's book, Boss, which we'll discuss in another part of this series, is got a great account of the tearing down of neighborhoods to build the university and some of the people involved in that. And there's also in Studs Terkel's book, Division Street America, there's some really mm-hmm. good stuff, some interviews with the some of the leaders of that movement about, you know, it's really interesting because they're normal people. They're just people who are living their lives, who don't think of themselves as community leaders, mm-hmm. who have this kind of thrust upon them, again, in a kind of passive voice way. And they see that they need to become active participants in order to save their friends, save their neighborhoods. That's not what these kids are doing in Blight. I guess we should talk about the story. they're doing the opposite of saving their neighborhood.
I love it when they're like, hey, what is this Blight? You know, like, this has nothing to do with ecstasy. And they're like, let's go look for Blight. And they're going around and like, what? These are like the trees and the weeds have always been here. Nothing's changed. And then they're like, there's no Blight around here. And then immediately, what do they do? Like, well, there's this Chrysler that somebody had, you know, abandoned in the, you know, down the block from us. And we started mm-hmm. taking it apart and using pieces of the windshield wiper to hit each other with. And, you know, it's sort of like, there's this like comical, like lack of self-awareness of what, mm-hmm. like what the kind of the bureaucrats would consider blight.
Yeah,
for them, well, that's their world.
It's their world. And they, the thing that I really love about this story is it's that they create from the blight. This story is, in a lot of his stories, one of the things I really love about his stories is that they're often about music in some way. Mm-hmm. Music always is playing a very big role in Dybeck's story. So Chopin in Winter, which you alluded to earlier, is entirely about, it's about someone playing a piano in the apartment upstairs and hearing the music traveling down the pipes of the building, and she's been to university and come back. She's been on a scholarship that she's lost because the young woman has become pregnant, and she won't say who the father is, and she's upstairs playing these Chopin pieces all night, and this boy is talking about it with his grandfather, and so it's entirely about music, that story, and about the mm-hmm. music of, you've already talked about the building that's set in, and it's about the music of not just literally Chopin's music and the kind of thing, but it's about the music of those relationships between this older girl who lives in the building and this younger boy who kind of is fascinated by her and enamored of her, and the relationship between him and his deadbeat grandfather who's come to stay for a temporary time, and the relationship between the deadbeat grandfather and the rest of the family, and the music is kind of the sound of the city, literally is one of the things tying it together. But in Blight, they're literally constantly making music out of the blight. You know, they literally make music out of that car you were just talking about.
Yeah. They start using it for rhythm as they, I love it, and the viaducts underneath, you know, because you've got to the north of 18th Street, you have this, you know, large rail yard, because there are a lot of old steel mills that were closing down by the 50s. But so you've got you got this rail infrastructure, International Harvester, so McCormick, Reaper, you know, kind of the beginning of labor movement in the United States. All this stuff happens in that area there. You got these huge rail infrastructure. So you got these viaducts where you might have, you know, in some areas, you know, 20 different, you know, 20 tracks all together. And so a viaduct that lasts for a quarter mile, others, but for the most part, at least three or four tracks going across. So these pretty deep bridges that make for really great echoes, the kind of thing that, mm-hmm. you know, I don't know about you, but whenever I go into those kinds of things, I always feel compelled to like make some sort of, some sort of noise just to,
you gotta
just
test
to check
the acoustics.
The quality.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And sometimes it's really disappointing.
That's what they're doing. Sometimes it's like, oh, that's pretty dead.
Yeah, it's really, but when you nail it, it's really exciting. This is my favorite paragraph in this entire book. Yeah, exactly. This is my favorite paragraph in this entire book is this moment, because it's all these things are kind of coming together. This is page 48. We'd stand at the shadowy mouth of the viaduct, peering at the greenish gleam of light at the other end of the tunnel. The green was the grass and trees of Douglas Park. Pepper would begin slamming an aerial or board or chain off the girders, making echoes collide and ring, while Ziggy and I clunked empty bottles and beer cans, and all three of us would be shouting and screaming like Screamin' Jay or Howlin' Wolf, like those choirs of unleashed voices we'd hear on Jam with Sam's late night blues show. So like all the things they're using as instruments, it's like the girders of the viaduct, it's broken or like empty beer bottles, it's the aerial that they've ripped off the car that you mentioned earlier, the chain that they found lying on the ground. You're literally using the things of blight to make music and to make exciting mm-hmm. music. And I'm going to read a little further. Sometimes a train streamed by, booming overhead like part of the song, and we'd shout louder yet. And I'd remember my father telling me how he could have been an opera singer if he hadn't ruined his voice as a kid imitating trains. Once a gang of black kids appeared on the Douglas Park end of the viaduct and stood harmonizing from bass through falsetto, just like the Coasters, so sweetly, though at first we tried out shouting them, we finally shut up and listened, except for Pepper keeping the beat. We applauded from our side, but stayed where we were, and they stayed on theirs. That's that border stay the same, but the neighborhood shifting. That's one of those moments, those kind of liminal moments in between things. And there's this uneasiness that's transformed by the music, and the music that's transforming it is coming from them. And I really love that. I just think it's a beautiful evocation of so many like layers of meaning of urban space and the people in urban spaces. And he does this kind of thing a lot, Stuart Dybeck, because it's a thing that he's a real master of, is that kind of, I guess, the poetic image of those things and the resonances of those things and the kind of dreaminess of them. And that, to me, that paragraph is just, it's the best.
Yeah, I that one I also is one that I highlighted because it's so Chicago.
Yeah,
and I'm sure you could probably say this in other cities, but it like the particularities of that, all the different things you were saying about the kids and kind of using the artifacts of their life to create something. Dybeck talked about how the city, the Chicago, you know, people talk about it being a city of neighborhoods, and he often thought of it as a city of borders.
Yeah.
And the viaduct there, you know, Douglas Park is part of what's called North Lawndale and is a, you know, 98% African-American community. So that's to the north of the railroad tracks there. And then sometimes Little Village is directly south of that down California. I assume this is the California Street Viaduct. And there's an L station there. That's where I used to get off to go to work. And to the south there used to be, that's Dybeck lived down there for a while too in his life. And so that was Polish. There's an Italian section there, Czech, German. But by this time, it's the Poles, you know, to the, on the south side of the viaduct there are leaving. And to the north there, around Douglas Park, is transitioning. It had been actually a very Jewish neighborhood. So nowadays, most of the big Baptist church up there are old synagogues, you know, with, you know, the Ten Commandments in stone and Hebrew above the doors. And so that's all happening, kind of that transition's all happening right there at the California Street Viaduct. Mm-hmm. And he, which comes up in some other stories, and he's got one in another book of his that I read recently. And this amazing description of a band, marching band, going a little bit too far through the viaduct, getting a little too carried away. It's just fantastic. The kind of the clash of two neighborhoods coming together again with music.
It's funny. You said that this is like strikes you as a particularly Chicago thing. And I think you're not wrong there. There's another thing that's in this story that comes up again in Hot Ice that you also see in other works of Chicago literature, which I might come back to, that I think is also a very Chicago thing and certainly part of my like own and your own Chicago. I'm going to tell you about your own experience, Chicago experiences. I'm only saying it because we've done it together, but it's about like going to the lake. And like, there's a really nice Carl Sandburg poem. So there's another episode in this series where we talked about poetry of Carl Sandburg. And one of the poems we didn't talk about in that is called The Harbor. And it's about break coming through the skyscrapers with people sort of huddling in the doorways and stuff, and then breaking out at the lakefront and the gulls are wheeling and the waves are crashing. Like, and it's a really nice poem because it gives you the sense of what the lake means to the city, where you come out of buildings and then you hit the lakefront and it's there and it's big and the sky seems endless and the water seems endless. And you see this image come up again and again in literature. So that's a poem, which counts as literature, I'm pretty sure. But so like yeah, there's a key scene in Studs Lonnegan by James T. Farrell, where Studs and his friend Kenny go out. They take it's kind of the same journey that these guys make from a very similar part of town. They're a little further south, I think, in Studs Lonnegan. They're like at 43rd, something like that. But they come up on the streetcar and they go swimming, and it's about the kind of freedom they feel outside of their neighborhood, which is, again, it's one of these neighborhoods that's transitioning from Jewish and Irish to Italian and African-American, and all these things are kind of happening. And there's lots of tension in it. You know, the 1919 race riots are the flashpoint for them was kids swimming in the lake and enjoying that freedom. And then it being exploded. It's the freedom is always a delicate thing. In this story, you have to come back to Blight, and they want to come back to Blight. They're always coming, you know, it's a refrain through the story, back to Blight. And every time he says it, it means something slightly different. It's always got a double meaning to it, just kind of a light touch double meaning, because it's always literal and there's always something about the kind of resonance of what Blight means that's different. But they go to Oak Street Beach. And they say,
which I love his description of it, because it's totally, he says the discerning, the beach for discerning individuals, yeah, or something. I was like, that's totally true.
It's it's the bottom of 44. Go ahead and read it out.
Oak Street Beach, which we regarded as the beach of choice for sophisticates. The
beach of choice for sophisticates.
Like, totally.
That's why we went there when we were kids, right?
Totally. That's exactly why we went there. That was the beach of choice for us sophisticates. And I love, you know, it's like, you know, that's the classy beach.
Yeah.
He's got another, I know we're not talking about I Sailed with Magellan, but his story, We Didn't, mm-hmm. is one of the best short stories I've ever read, takes place on Oak Street Beach. But I love the going. You're talking about the kind of the coming and going between the two. Is it Blight where he, or is it another one where he winds up having a girlfriend for a period of time who lives up?
Yeah, that's in Blight. That's it's just a little bit after this part. I want to just like look at the description of Oak Street Beach. He says, at the Oak Street Beach, the city seemed to realize our dreams of it, which I just love. It seemed to realize our dreams of it. The city, like, again, it's this moment where like you're no longer in this blighted neighborhood where you make music out of junk, except the making the music out of junk, the city is realizing your dreams of it too. And it's just these spaces where it's not that time stops, but like your sense of yourself in relation to the city changes, and the city becomes something better than what it is actually. And these stories do that again and again. That I guess the point I'm driving towards is the way that these things that are seemingly grubby, Blight, an official Blight area, become the stuff of art, and like that matters. Like it doesn't make the city better. It doesn't make the stuff that happens is it called We Didn't? Yeah.
We isn't it We Didn't?
We Didn't. Yeah. The things that happen there. I mean, that story is amazing because it takes you on one ride and then it cuts underneath you.
A totally different journey.
It turns
into
a much more harrowing story than it starts. It starts out as kind of just like a comedy, a kind of sex comedy, basically. About a kid trying to lose his virginity on Oak Street Beach.
Yeah, all of his unfulfilled dreams. All the different places where it didn't work out.
And become something more harrowing. So like that, the art doesn't remove that, the actual dangers and the actual difficulties of the city, but it does allow the city to once in a while seem to realize our dreams for it. We gazed out nonchalantly at the white-sailed yachts on the watercolor blue horizon, or back across the outer drive at the lake reflecting glass walls of high-rises, as if we took such splendor for granted. As if we took such splendor for granted. And then, you know, at the end of it, it's like, back to Blight. We've had our great day at the beach, like sophisticates.
But, in Chicago, you get – it's really and you see this in a couple of different characters in the story here, where like they never actually go anywhere near downtown.
Yeah,
you know, the city, you know, even by the 60s it was like looming skyscrapers, and you could see them from anywhere, right? They're just looming above you, and yet you have, you know, kids who have never been there. It's, you know, a short L ride away, but you have kids who never went to Oak Street Beach, never have gone down into the Loop. That's super common, and he talks about it here. And it was still common when I worked on the West Side, that lots of kids, you know, in spite of like staring in every day at these huge buildings, had never actually been into those areas. And I think part of what he's talking about here is that he was able to feel like he belonged there, like, you know, the beach for, you know, they're sophisticates with their band and their, you know, their emerging poetry that they're writing. And they feel like they belong there, at least for a time. And then even, you know, go for the day and then come back. But a lot of the other people in his stories, they don't feel like they belong there at all.
Yeah.
Like, and it, so for them, does the city ever really realize their dreams, or help them, make them feel like they belong.
No, that's a really good point.
Part of the challenge.
It's a really good point. Because the other guys in this story, so again, it's that opening sentence between those years between Korea and Vietnam. And there's the other guys in the story who are these older guys who are Korean war vets who used to play softball and now are just too, basically, they've been drinking it. They've been playing softball for their taverns, and now they've been at the tavern so long they're not really, they can't play ball anymore.
Play
they
softball.
All got beer bellies, and and they're a real image of what happens if the city doesn't allow you to realize your dreams of it. And you know, these guys are broken by their experience and the neighborhood, the blight they've come back to, and that doesn't offer them anything. The writer Willie Vlauten talked once about, or more than once, he's talked about like being a kid. He grew up in Reno, Nevada, and he talks about growing up in Reno and like getting to a certain age where he could you know, kind of sneak into the bars or whatever. And like, there are these guys, these older guys there who seemed really cool. These guys in their kind of 30s sitting at the bar drinking, and when they sneak him a drink or whatever, and they seemed really fun and cool. And he's like, then you get to that age and you realize how like unfun and uncool they are. And this is kind of, this story performs that image of that as well. Cause at the end, these guys really, you know, they're just there a couple of times in the story. They're part of what I called the kind of fabric of the story with music and stuff earlier, but they're just, there's a real brokenness in like these guys in this story who have these moments at the beach or have like, they go, so you mentioned his girlfriend, he goes up north to see Debbie Weiss, who thinks that the north side is better because the streets have names.
So that's,
and his response to that is brilliant.
There's so much truth in there's so much truth in that attitude, and I love like people on the south side. Like, what? How do you get around? Like people on the north. Like yeah. It's so funny because the south side, for the most part, all the streets are numbers, yeah. Or the you know the east west streets and up north. And I love that she's like, well, do you know? She's condescending to him. Like, well, do you know how to get there? Yeah. Like as if like not having street numbers, like he's not smart enough to be able to figure it out. And he's like, no, I know.
But also, he isn't.
And then I love the fact that he actually gets lost. But that's again like such a great little Chicago detail about like north side, south side.
It gets captured really brilliantly. A number lacks character, David. How can you have a feeling for a street called 22nd? She asked. She'd never been on the south side except for a trip to the museum. Like that's the answer. He doesn't answer in the story. He doesn't answer, but the narrator answers it. Like, well, if you've only ever been down to the museum, then you can't. You don't know. How could you know? How could you know that feeling?
You know what's funny about that sentence is that 22nd is actually one of the very few streets on the south side that is more popularly known by a name, which is Cermak. Yeah. So most you'll get a lot of people will be like, oh yeah, Cermak. It's one of the few exceptions on the south side.
I really want to talk about Hot Ice because I think you know there's a kind of first of all, Hot Ice fits quite neatly with Blight as a kind of companion story. It's about a similar group of kids, but when you talk about
a little older, a little further on,
when you talk about writers from Chicago or Chicago literature, at least for me, and I think for a lot of others, there's always this kind of constellation you have to do. You're always trying to fit them together because they're all writing about the city. Because there's so many great writers, particularly in the middle of the 20th century, from the city, who kind of a lot of the feeling about the city is shaped by these artists in a way that we were talking about. Like the dreams of the city are realized through its art. And you know, I've mentioned James T. Farrell already and Carl Sandburg, and we've done podcasts and a bunch of other writers as well, and have more to come in this series. And it's kind of easy to slide them in ways that are not quite true some of the time. Like Saul Bellow, you know, is this in some ways a Chicago writer that people will like to stake claim, like, oh, this guy's like Bellow. And I've heard Dybeck compared to Bellow, which doesn't really make sense to me. But Algren is the one who I think really, like, Dybeck is like the nephew of Nelson Algren. And I'll tell you a couple of reasons why I think that. And I think Hot Ice is the story that best does it. And I'm just trying to stop myself from talking about Nelson Algren too much. Like, but because it's not the Nelson Algren series, it's the Literature of Chicago. But like, it's partly about the taking seriously those Blight areas. So Algren calls them the lives of the people behind the billboards. And in fact, there's an image somewhere that Dybeck uses that phrase somewhere in this collection, but I can't recall off the top of my head exactly where. He talks about people being behind the billboards. It's just a brief little, I think it's a little tip of the cap to Algren.
Yeah. Well, and the image itself is so, I mean, you're riding on the L,
yeah,
and you have these billboards that are built to advertise to people riding on the L, and they're oftentimes right in front of people's back windows. And so like, that's like, what a great, I can totally feel that.
Yeah. And like, and I think Dybeck's sympathy for those people and for the places and like the, so like for Algren, it's, you know, that Wicker Park, that corner of Wicker Park around Division Street, another like super changed and changing neighborhood from that time. It's unrecognizable from Algren's time. But and the interest in creating a kind of poetry out of that, the lyrical way in which both those guys write about these places without becoming, again, without becoming sentimental about it, but giving a lyricism to lives that is a kind of affirmation or it's affirming of the dignity of those lives lived in these squalid places is something that I think Dybeck does again and again in a way that really is in that same, I don't know, I'd be reluctant to call it a tradition, but it's in the same kind of mode or the same kind of attitude, mm-hmm. you know, towards place that Ahlgren has. And I think that the comparison kind of ends there, I suppose. And I called him his like nephew, his like literary nephew, which I think is, you know, enough. And it's not that he's imitating or anything. It's just he's capturing a certain thing in a similar way that I like. And Hot Ice for me is the one that does it the most, partly because it has echoes of that, one of Ahlgren's most famous stories, How the Devil Came Down Division Street, which is about drunks. And it's a kind of an urban legend story. And this is a story of an urban legend about a young Polish woman who is taken out on a rowboat under the lagoon.
I think so.
Taken out under the lagoon by a couple of sailors who essentially try to rape her, and she drowns escaping from them. And her father carries her. And there's three or four different versions of this part told, and no one agrees on what's the truest version because it's an urban legend. Carries her either on the streetcar or in a taxi or whatever to the ice house that he owns, and puts her in the freezer and covers it, this block of ice that freezes around her, covers it with dry ice to keep it permanently frozen. And then she becomes a kind of localized saint, and the urban legend seeps into the Catholic schools that these kids go to. So even the nuns kind of know and respect this urban legend, and it's everything about it is like pseudo supernatural. And Dybeck is a kind of master of this kind of thing, of just taking you on this realistic journey that just tips at times into something not necessarily surreal, but hyper real or otherworldly, and then drawing you back into the realism of it. And again, this is like about the city realizing its dreams, kind of moments. But there's a lot of characters in this long story.
Yeah, he takes, and I think he does it the most here, he takes urban legends seriously.
Yeah.
You know, almost at face value in a sense, but not, but even like he values them more than that, you know, like, so it's this sort of, you know, like, oh yeah, there's the, you know, the old guy, and you know, there's some grain of truth in all of this, you know, maybe his daughter did die in this way. And this is like really tragic thing. Right. But he's the local ice, you know, supplier. So like there becomes this whole other element, like, oh yeah, they say they keep her body back there. And you can see how this like would develop over time. And then all of these other characters start to weave into it.
It's driven, a lot of it is driven by an old drunk, Antek the drunk, which again, Antek is the name. This is like another Ahlgren thing. I mean, it's not like it's a particularly rare name necessarily, but Antek is the guy who owns the Tug and Maul in The Man with the Golden Arm. He's a secondary but important character in The Man with the Golden Arm. And here there's a drunk called Antek. And I just kind of like Antek the owner and Antek the drunk here. I like that resonance, whether it doesn't mean much beyond that. I just like it as a resonance. But he's the guy who kind of drives the legend because he's had his life saved by this sainted woman and got fired for it. But
he works for him. Yeah. Right? And he's like, he winds up, he's totally drunk and he gets locked in the, in the ice box and for like over the entire weekend or, you know, 3 days. And the only way he survives is that she keeps his body warm.
The kind of glow of her aura keeps him warm. And then on Monday, her old man unlocks and sees him in there and says, "You're fired." And that's the only words that they say. The whole thing is, this is like, you can imagine this whole thing being told at the whatever tavern, you know.
Oh, totally. By the old guys sitting there, you know, wearing their old softball shirts and like, you know, slipping a little beer to the kids who are trying to sneak in. You know, it's like the stuff of urban legend.
But then he kind of like, there's this great, the way this story ends is they're going to tear down the ice house, So like back to that. And in fact, it's this story that that line that I read at the beginning comes from: boundaries remained intact while neighborhoods came and went. So this is like a boundary. It's one of those, this is one of those buildings that's been there forever. It hasn't been an ice house forever. And this is partly what's breeding the legend. It's like, even though the ice house isn't the ice house, like that, you know, it's still, she's the still there house, in the hot ice. And then there's the great scene where they've all gotten little pieces of dry ice and are playing around with them and stuff in the street. And it, but they go with Antek down to the ice house because it's going to be torn down, and they can't stand the idea of the of this sainted body being demolished with the building. They need to,
it's a desecration.
Yeah, they need to, they need to like free her, you know, like in Blight it's north to freedom, you know. I think
north to freedom was their joke.
The sophisticated, north to freedom, back to Blight, you know. And they need to release her out of, she can't be permanently crushed under the Blight. They need to release her to freedom. So they break in. The way that that part is told is great because it's told from the point of view of Antek, the wino. And like, he sends them in and he's sitting out there with a bottle of wine that he finishes and throws, again, the music of Blight. He throws it and listens to the sound of it clanging. And it's all his perspective, which is this kind of slightly muddled, but with that like momentary clarity of proper drunkenness. And he's both watching and imagining them doing what they're doing at the same time. So it's never quite real and never quite not real. And the end of this story, it doesn't ruin anything for anybody because it's like, the story is, all these Dybek stories are just about how they're told, not really about some cliffhanger that happens. But they push her on the old like rusty rails that led in and out of the back of this place, and they push her body down this on a trolley that's covered in a tarp, and it describes it. And then he knew now where they were taking her, where she would finally be released. They were rushing through the waist-deep weeds, crossing the vast tracts of prairie behind the factories, clattering over bridges and viaducts. Below, streetlights shimmered watery in the old industrial neighborhoods. Shiny with sweat, the girl already melting free between them. They forced themselves faster, rowing like a couple of sailors. And like, I mean, that I love the vastness of the image. You can see almost the entire Midwest across the prairies. And then, and these guys, it redeems the beginning of the story. They really are making her a saint in this moment with that simile, like a couple of sailors. She's been killed by a couple of sailors at the beginning, and these kids of the neighborhood, the sailors are, they're real sailors. They're not part of the neighborhood. They're taking advantage of her or the neighborhood, whatever. And these two kids are become real sailors in the simile, even though they're not real sailors, like a couple of sailors, part of the neighborhood. And it just redeems the saintliness of the moment, the neighborhood, the trauma, whatever. I think it's just a wonderful, I don't know. I feel like I've just given you a lecture that you didn't ask for.
No, it's, I love that story. And then all of that weaves through the story of, like, was it Eddie and Pancho?
Yeah.
Is it Eduardo?
Yeah.
And so you get, you know, here you start to see kind of the, they're, you know, these guys, I don't know, how old are they? Probably early 20s.
Yeah.
Maybe 20 or so, maybe even late.
The story
teens,
kind of takes place over a period of years because they're younger at the beginning because it talks about Pancho being an altar boy.
Pancho is...
He's like a blissed out altar boy.
Totally. And like the nuns all love him. And he's like, he can't do any wrong. And whereas Eddie's like, can't do right. Yeah. Right. And of course, Pancho's the one who gets himself locked up in Cook County Jail, which is also in the neighborhood.
Yeah,
here
and
too.
It's a real, is a real force in this story. It's a real character unto itself and a force and looms over everything. Sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off.
The judge say? Like, you're too pretty to go to jail, but sends him to jail anyway.
And well, the judge like kind of gives him like three. This is a very Algren moment as well. The judge keeps saying to him, like, tell me this and I'll let you go. And he's sitting there with his tie tied around his head and a jacket that says something on the back and just refuses all of the mercy that's being given to him and disappears into the penal system.
Yep. And he physically disappears from the book, but he continues to be there. And which is actually something that I found to weave through this whole, all of these stories, is the presence of things that are no longer there. Mm-hmm. He has this amazing awareness of the influence of things. And I think this is, you know, when you have people in a culture that have been in a place for a while, you have this kind of collective memory or this individual memory of things that have changed and gone. And so, like, Pancho continues to be a character in the book, even when he's not an active character in the book. He's driving the narrative in ways, and they're actually trying to go visit him by, you know, wandering around outside the walls and yelling into the prison yard that they can't see, and usually not getting any response, mm-hmm. Except when Eddie gets particularly belligerent and starts being a total jerk to, and you know, saying all these really incendiary things to the guys inside, who then start shouting back at him. But they circumambulate Cook County Jail, mm-hmm. Which is California and California and 26th, and then it goes down to the, I guess that's the it's the river, but it's really the sanitary canal. Yeah. And so, but they circumambulate that, you know, at multiple points.
It's nice that we got a siren going by in the background while you were talking about the jail. I feel like it added a little bit of ambiance to our discussion. Yeah. Sorry.
That story definitely, I love the weaving together of all of these things. And it's sort of the legend and then so it's sort of like these guys, they live this life and they're, you know, trying to grow up and get jobs and be able to pay some bills. And then, but so much of their kind of understanding of the world is animated through this legend, mm-hmm. you know, this kind of, this is where they're from and who they're from. And yeah, it's a beautiful evocation. Even though it's actually kind of grim, a lot of it is just, you know, they're living a pretty tough life. And you're talking about, you know, I mean, we're, you know, the most beautiful thing here is, the beatified body of a woman who died trying to escape being raped. It's nothing particularly beautiful about that at all. No, but
it's again, it's like that's the connection to Ahlgren that I think is interesting. And it's not so much interesting as the connection is just like a way of sort of synthesizing, is that recognizing the tension between that kind of the beautiful moments and the squalor and the whatever else, and not falling into a trap of just of indulging either one of those things, but letting them live alongside each other in tension and letting those tensions be the things that drive stories and drive the poetry of the stories. It already, there's a good radio broadcast that you can listen to on the Studs Terkel archive with Stuart Dybeck from back in 1990 when this book came out. And Studs Terkel keeps circling back again and again to the epigraph to the book, which is from Antonio Machado. And the English translation of it is, out of the whole of memory, there's only one, out of the whole of memory, there's one thing worthwhile, the great gift of calling back dreams. And that's kind of the thing that's at stake in these stories. And then what you were talking about is that there's the memory, and then there's dreams, which are a kind of memory, as that quotation would have it. And there's the calling back of those things together to create something worthwhile. It's really wonderful. But I was going to suggest that we just have a quick talk about the death of the right fielder as a way of wrapping it up.
Oh, man. It's such a wonderful – there's a few of these. That one – I love the little interstitial chapters too.
Yeah.
But the death of the right fielder, it's almost like one of those interstitial chapters, but more fleshed out.
Yeah, I have an uneasy an uneasy attitude towards the interstitial chapters, which is my own problem. Because they're great, and I don't entirely understand why they're presented that way, and it bugs me that I don't quite understand that, which is my problem. Because also some of them are so good.
Except the outtakes one where he's an usher. Yeah. It's just like I think it's written over two pages, but they could fit it onto one. Probably is just, it's such perfect writing, and such a lovely kind of care for who pays attention to the usher, right? I mean, it doesn't even, the role doesn't even exist anymore, basically, in a movie theater, at least it's described here. And yet for him, like, he treats it with this, that it's the greatest thing, right? For him, like, that was his dream job as a kid. So he writes this like lovely little description of the art of it.
Yeah.
And it's sort of like amplified and to the surreal extent, as if like that's the show, right? Yeah. That's the most important thing in a film is the usher.
Is the usher treading across treading across the popcorn in a way that doesn't make a sound.
Yeah. But yeah, you're the death of the right fielder. It's just is great and super American, super kind of mid-century American, yeah. I think, especially, and super kind of childhood grandeur.
It also, what interests me in particular about this story, I can never get my students to talk about it for exactly the reasons that you just said. It's too American for a group of students in an English university classroom to get their heads around. But it's a story that the thing that interests me so much about it is that it almost like sentence by sentence is oscillating between realism and total surrealism, because it's about these kids playing baseball and they at some point in the game they realize every time they hit it to right field the ball doesn't come back, and so it already doesn't make any sense as a realistic story, right? Like they go out there and this kid is lying there dead and there's all this speculation. It becomes another urban legend, like how he died. They end up burying him in right field, and like he's a soldier, they plant a bat with a cap on it, almost like it's like a cross with dog tags on it. And and it's a real, it in like three pages, this story encapsulates all the things that we were talking about, which is why I wanted to raise it as our kind of way of finishing up our conversation, because it's a hymn to like the lost people and the lost talent and the lost ambition and the lost possibilities of the neighborhood and the people who you go to school with or grow up with, who you think, oh my God, they're the most talented thing, or they're the most interesting person or whatever. And they vanish and you don't know what becomes of them, like Pancho vanishing into prison. And this is like a kid who wasn't even that good. He was playing right field because nobody hits the ball out there in a pickup game of baseball. And he's still being eulogized as though, you know, he was the Roberto Clemente of the neighborhood. And it's a really beautiful thing. And it can only be done in this like called up dream style that Dybek creates for it. And I just love the story so much. And I, whenever I teach it, I feel like, does anyone want to talk about this story? And they all go, I want to demand like Professor Frink that they understand it on as many levels as I do.
it's so weighted in kind of that time and place that I can't imagine reading this as a, you know, a kid, you know, a young person, you know, 20-year-old, you know, somebody born in 2000 in England, sitting in a college class. Like, I don't know what they would make of it. You'd have to, like, just the nuance, the idea that, well, he couldn't have died of, like, leukemia, because those are the truly tragic ones, and really only the good ones die that way. You know, it's got to be something more mundane. You know, maybe it was a straight bullet.
Well, yeah, it's like a sniper.
A sniper. I love this idea that, like, you know, leukemia is this like grand and noble way to die and only the good ones go that way. But then also like the idea that, like, you're the right fielder, like, you know, if you've got majority of people are hitting right-handed and they're not very good at hitting, there's very few of them, they're going to hit the ball into the right field. They're going to pull it in the left field. So you put your worst player out in right field and that way it doesn't have to do too much.
Basically, there's
all these subtle.
Yeah, there's basically like a term's worth of lectures to give in order that we can then at the end of the term read the story that's three pages long. Yeah. And I suppose that's like one of the things that's really so great about this book of stories, The Coast of Chicago, and about Stuart Dybek's writing more generally, is that there's a wealth of stuff going on in these stories, and they're never that long, the stories. I mean, there are longer stories and shorter stories in the book, but the longest story is like 30, 40 pages, and word-wise, it's shorter than that sounds.
It's broken up into sections, almost separate stories within it.
But there's so much going on and so much to love in that kind of line-by-line lyrical way, and so much to admire and be challenged by on a thematic and storytelling way. And it's really wonderful. Book.
Mm-hmm. I love the way that he takes seriously the kind of the mundane experiences of people, and he treats, you know, all the whether it's kind of gritty and ugly or you know easily identified as something beautiful like a work of Chopin, he treats it all as kind of worth our attention and focus and care, and they're often woven together and in ways that are familiar to him. You could tell that it's all familiar to him, and it's not nostalgic. Like kind of, I thought at first, I was like, oh, is this gonna be like boomer nostalgia? But it really isn't. He takes the stuff of our daily lives, and especially of children's daily lives, and kind of fleshes them out, and it depicts it all as a kind of thing of beauty, warts and all.
Gregory Miller, thank you so much for joining me on the Novel Romantics Literature of Chicago podcast. It's been great having you and great talking to you about the coast of Chicago.
Thanks for having me, Doug. It's been a pleasure.
Just so you know, once again, the views and opinions expressed on the show are those of the guests or the host, not the American Centrum, which does not take any institutional positions on politics or policy. Thanks again for listening.